Welcome to It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Copeland. Featuring stimulating in-depth interviews with special guests from all areas of the arts. And now, here's your host for It's a Question of Balance, Ruth Copeland.
Welcome to the show where we balance the intellectual with the creative and explore whether we have more in common than divides us through thought-provoking conversations. For the topic hour, I go out on the street and talk to people about a wide range of different topics. And for this, the arts hour, I interview local, national and international guests from all areas of the arts. And I combine a discussion topic with a creative arts interview because I feel discussion and creativity are two of the most vital ways we engage with the world. I've been out and about recently covering the Cinequest Film Festival in Silicon Valley, and this week I'm featuring guests from the film The Dunning Man, which had its world premiere at Cinequest. The film is a whirlwind slice of life on the wilder side, focused on Connor, a young landlord trying to get his money while also doing right by people. Quite a challenge when his tenants include Chechen animal trainers with underworld ties, a rap star who parties so hard the neighbours can't sleep, and a struggling, good-hearted single mother who might just steal the landlord's heart. The film stars James Carpinello as Connor. And I talked to the filmmakers in the foyer of the iconic California Theatre in San Jose. It's amazing how many different people is necessary to make a movie happen. And I'm very happy to be featuring some of those people today to give us an insight into how a feature film comes about. First, let's hear from the director, Michael Clayton, and producer, Kevin Fortuna. So I'm here at Cinequest with Michael Clayton, who is the director and screenwriter of the film The Dunning Man, which had its world premiere at Cinequest. First, I guess I should ask you, for listeners, what does The Dunning Man refer to? It's quite an unusual title.
Dunning is an old word, and it, you owe me money, I come to you saying, pay me, pay me, pay me, I'm dunning you.
Right.
So dunning, to dun someone is to try to get money from them that they owe you.
Okay, cool. So can you just give us a little synopsis of what the film's about for listeners?
Yeah, our hero, Connor Ryan, he is coming back home to Atlantic City to save what is left of his business. He was in real estate. He has three condominiums left to his name, and he's trying to hang on, but he has problems with tenants, to say the least. And so he's dealing with a Russian mobsters, a lady that he has a crush on that can't afford to pay her rent, and I guess you'd say a retired rapper who's trying to start again. And with all the craziness of Atlantic City, he's just trying to hang on to all that.
Yes, yeah. It's quite an unusual slice of life story. How did you become involved with the project?
Kevin and I were in grad school together it was a prose, we were writing fiction, and
I should just say, Kevin Fortuna is the producer, and he wrote the novella, or short story that the film is based on.
Yeah, and we were in classes together, we were workshopping stories, and so he'd seen some of what I did, and of course I knew his work, and when he started the process of moving towards making a film of it, he just at one point asked me if I wanted to take a pass at the screenplay, and yeah, absolutely. So
I understand that you originally trained in film, but then you were a literature teacher, and this is your first feature film, is that right?
It is. I'm a high school literature teacher, yeah. I was in film school with all the film nerds, and I started taking literature classes just to kind of help with my writing, and I fell in love with that, and so I ended up teaching instead.
And what attracts you to film as an art form?
It starts from childhood. I mean, I loved movies. I mean, I grew up in a rural area, very, very small Georgia southern town, and films were, you know, they were outside. They were dreams. It's like you get to see something besides the pastures and the woods, and So, and it just as I've gotten older and learned more about it, it's just been the way I experience stories is visually and orally. I mean, I like to read and write, but I still see them, and that's the way I come to know the characters and the worlds there.
The lead character in the film is quite compelling. What attracted you to his story, and what do you think he's trying to achieve in the film?
Yeah, that's the hardest question always for me. It's like I can't really write a character until you figure that out, and that took a while. We went back and forth, and for me, it's like in screenwriting, everybody wants you to have that thing, that MacGuffin, that thing he's trying to get. And there wasn't one that I thought felt real to him. It's like everything I thought, he's like, he doesn't want that. But what I finally started thinking is what he does want is to not be who he was. But he doesn't know how to be something else yet. So that's what this film's doing. So the short-term goal is he wants to hang on to those condominiums. But in the process, it's like all these things that doing that requires him to be, he doesn't want to be. So really what he wants is to just try to be a better version of himself, and the world these days makes it hard, you know.
And it kind of is a hero's tale in a way, but in a very realistic, down-to-earth sense. I mean, he finds himself in some very unusual, challenging situations, and like you say, I mean, I don't want to give too much away about the film, but he is a decent person, isn't he? And I think in a way that's but quite inspiring, although it's, you know, he's not sort of saving people drowning or anything like that, but it's quite inspiring to see someone meet these challenges and deal with them from a place of integrity.
Yeah, I mean, you're right, it's a hero story, but it's like he had to first realize that he wasn't a hero, you know, because we're not all born just straight good guys. And that's a big part of the struggle for him, is him coming to the reality that he doesn't like everything that he's done. And it's not like he's mistreating people all the time, but it's just, if I want to go out and have this real estate or this property and make this money or do this, then sometimes he's had to put other things that he thinks matters on the back burner. But but over the course of this, he starts to figure out that, okay, this is who I want to be, which is harder. I mean, being the good guy is harder. It always is.
And there's also a theme. I mean, he makes some not very great decisions, and so do other characters, and how that plays out and how people learn from that. Was that something you also wanted to draw out with the screenplay?
Yeah, I just wanted to show that it's hard to change. I mean, one, it's hard to walk a straight and narrow just in the world these days. I mean, it's like I teach high school. If I want to be the best teacher I can be, it's hard to do because I have to pay attention to these standardized tests kids have to pass, and we have to deal with parents, administrations. It's hard to do sometimes what you really want or believe that you should do. And I wanted to show all these things that can get people sidetracked. And I wanted to show other versions of Connor. It's like, you know, throughout the rest of the story, these other characters, in some ways, they're things he aspires to be, things that he could be. I mean, the good, the bad, and, you know, so I just wanted him to be where we are with everything pushing and pulling and us trying to figure it out.
One of the things that interests me about all forms of art is the potential to help us both as people consuming art and making art to process things about our own lives, maybe difficult things. Do you see a potential for art and maybe this film even to do that?
It absolutely does that. I mean, it's for me, the film that started, this is cliched, but I mean, I was 6 years old watching Star Wars, and I was afraid of getting hit by a baseball when I played Little League Baseball. But if I pictured myself as a Jedi Knight, I could play and I wasn't scared. And that's simplistic, but you just extend that over time, and, you know, as you mature and the issues get more complicated. But yeah, these things still, they show us what we are. For good or ill, and yeah, the hope is that we see what we could be and how to be something. That's the hard part, how to be something different. It's easy to aspire to, yeah, I want to be that, but the best films can kind of show you how to go about being that person.
Yes. Well, Kevin Fortuna has joined us now. You wrote the original short story book that the film is based on. What made you want to tell the story in the book? I know it's slightly different to the film, but
It's really simple. So we had this workshop. We'd go to San Miguel de Allende every year for a couple of years, and a bunch of us who got to know each other and got to become friends would sit around in workshops and talk about each other's writing. And I think immediately Michael and I developed an affinity, and we probably cared more about each other's opinions of our respective work than we did about the opinions of not everybody else, but like we relied on each other. It was like, yeah. If I had a story that I workshopped and he thought it was all right, then I was like, okay, that doesn't suck. Well, this is a story that pretty much everybody kind of embraced, and the general consensus was, that's a great short story, but you really got to make it a movie. There's something very visual, to use a word that Michael used. I mean, there's something visual about this story. It's a story set in a very weird place. Atlantic City is a weird place, very American place, a city that has been born and reborn, you know, once the queen of resorts. It's a town that's 2 hours driving distance from 60% of the nation's wealth, and yet you have acres and acres of undeveloped land sitting on beachfront property, right, behind casinos that cost $3 billion to build. So it's a land of dreams tried and dreams failed. Well, Connor's trying to realize a dream, the main character, and the best way he knows how to do that is to go home. And he's going home to this squalid, seedy, glorious, dirty place. But it's a place that is very important to him for reasons that your audience will find out. You know, it was clear to me that it belonged in movie form, and the friendship with Michael gave me a great way to get a screenplay together, because I'd never written a screenplay.
I mean, it is very much about the kind of underbelly of life, and it shows things, situations that most people perhaps wouldn't even imagine are happening. So why did you want to sort of show that side of life?
Well, I do have rental property in Atlantic City. Friends of mine in the business world say, like, why don't you dump all that property? Like, you're always dealing with broken toilets and faucets and garbage disposals, and you're getting calls in the middle of the night. I love doing it. I meet a bunch of interesting people, a bunch of smart people, some broken people, and the tenants in my properties in Atlantic City have shown me stuff that is stranger than fiction, stuff that inspired the short story and ultimately the film. And the story's not autobiographical in very many ways, but the stuff of my work as a landlord in Atlantic City really did inspire what we did in the story.
I thought the film was very well cast. I think that, you know, all the lead actors portrayed the characters in a really engaging way that did draw you in. Were you involved in the casting?
I was. We had casting sessions in New York, Atlanta, and New Orleans. Yeah, from the start, I think I was at every one of them. Yeah.
Well done. I think they were really compelling. Yes.
Yeah, for me, the whole thing for an actor is, it was like, do I watch it and do I believe it? I mean, if it feels like a guy acting, I know that's like duh, right? But if the guy's acting, if it doesn't feel real to me, but when these people did their part, all of them, it's like I'm putting checks on my paper. I'm saying that's it, you know.
Well, I hope the film gets a very wide audience, and thank you very much for speaking to me.
Oh, thank you very much.
So I might just say one thing. So I got a compliment last night at the after party of after we did the premiere in Redwood City, and I'm still riding high from this compliment. So somebody said to me, I haven't had that much fun watching a movie since I saw Pulp Fiction.
Yeah.
So people ask the question, I'm not comparing this film to Tarantino's films or to Pulp Fiction in particular, but I mean, that's what we were going for in a way. We wanted something that was fun, that was interesting, that was different. And, you know, I think in a lot of ways what Michael's screenplay does is it takes it to a different level. Yeah. So I think that's where the innovation comes in.
Right. You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copland, and my guests from the arts this week from the film The Dunning Man. We're going to a break now, but I'll be back with more conversation after these messages.
you like the music from It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Copeland? Have you ever wondered what the full songs sound like? Now you can find out by listening to the new EP, It's a Question of Balance Music, available from iTunes, Amazon, and itsaquestionofbalance.com.
Play the game, and I wish I knew your name. Something about you in the rain. Did I or didn't I say it's forever? Well, I know I said it, babe. It just goes nowhere. Well, we can do the things we want. We can do the things we like. Just don't think that it's right. I think that there's more to life than just that. I think that there's more to us than just that.
It's a Question of Balance Music. Download individual tracks or the whole EP from iTunes, Amazon, or itsaquestionofbalance.com.
Hi, I'm Casey, and I'm the second generation owner of Bookshop Santa Cruz. We pride ourselves on being Santa Cruz's community bookstore. We feature an extensive selection of new and used books, children's books and toys, gifts, cards, magazines, and games. Our knowledgeable booksellers can help you find just the right book or gift. We hope you can join us for our author events each week, featuring best-selling authors and books of local interest. And if you can't get downtown, our website has over 3.2 million titles, which ship directly to your home. We even have experts on site to help you publish your own book or family history. Come visit us downtown or at our website, bookshopsantacruz.com.
Bookshop Santa Cruz is celebrating 50 years of independent bookselling in the community that we love. Visit Bookshop Santa Cruz downtown and join in the festivities as we celebrate our customers and the books that make it all possible. Bookshop Santa Cruz, celebrating an amazing 50 years in downtown Santa Cruz.
Welcome back. You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copeland. And this week I'm featuring guests from the film The Dunning Man. I've been out and about covering the Cinequest Film Festival, and I was fortunate to be able to talk to some of the people involved with this film in the foyer of the iconic California Theatre in San Jose. And the film had its world premiere at Cinequest and was very well received. And it's very interesting, I think, how many people are involved in making feature films, or even short films, but you know, especially feature films. When you stay at the end, as I always do, and watch all the credits roll, I mean, it really is quite amazing how many people are involved, how many people are employed by feature films. And so I was very happy to be able to talk to the director, producer, music contributor, cinematographer, and editor to do with The Dunning Man. It's really giving us an idea of what it takes to make a good film. So next I spoke to Tom Kemp, who's one of the lead actors in the film. So let's hear my conversation with him. So I have Tom Kemp with me now, one of the lead actors from The Dunning Man. Firstly, can you tell us a bit about the character that you play in the film?
Uncle Bishop is James, the lead's uncle, and raised him from the time he was in high school when my brother and sister-in-law passed away in a car accident. He's an old-school Atlantic City. He is knows everybody. Everybody knows him. He may be attached to the Philadelphia mob. He may not be. And as I insist in the movie several times, I'm Irish. How could I possibly be attached or connected, as they say? But he might be. Don't know, but he knows everybody. Yeah. I really was very attracted to Uncle Bishop because he's very similar to a lot of the people I grew up with. I've not been in that world, but I've been in one similar. And it really, when I read the screenplay, when they sent me the script, I said, oh, I know this guy. You know, he's somebody that I really identified with. He's got a sense of a moral compass. It may be a little skewed. Yes. To everybody else's perception, but to Uncle Bishop it makes sense, and he likes to do the right thing. Yeah. He wants to do the right thing, but he's also, like Atlantic City, he's a struggler. You know, it's not easy for Bishop. He's a building contractor. He has guys working for him, and he's trying to just put one foot in front of the other and been able to do it. But he's a working stiff with some knowledge.
Yes, and so how do you go about embodying a character? What's your process for that?
I try to find the part of me that is closest to Bishop, to any character I do. I've been fortunate to have some roles like that, you know, where I can really identify with it. Otherwise, I've been a character actor for almost 40 years, you know.
I was going to ask you that. How did acting become your art form? How did you choose to get into this?
Well, yeah, the quick answer is I got my degree in theater from Northeastern University and just went on from there. But I did a lot of theater for reviews and not much money, and I drove a cab at the same time. But once it really like kicked in and I started doing film, that's where I really found my love. I loved that process of acting on film, and so I've been judges, I've been priests, I've been cardinals, I've been lawyers, I've been Irish thugs, I have been actually even played an Italian thug, you know. So I've played a lot of different roles, like grandpas now. I used to be the husband, you know, but now I'm the grandpa, So my career is, I've been very fortunate. I've worked with most of the great directors, you know, Woody Allen and Oliver Stone and Martin Scorsese and a lot of people, and it's and more than once, which is always a good sign.
Yes, absolutely.
And so yeah, I've covered the waterfront, as they say.
Yes.
And I'll be in the next season of House of Cards, which was a lot of fun to shoot. So,
Well, I really liked your character in this film, The Dunning Man. I think all of the characters very subtly had or reflected how nobody's black and white. You know, there are always shades of gray. Yeah.
I think that was the strength of it. I think, it went from the fantastic to the real and gritty in a very believable second, I thought. It was one of the nice parts about this movie. It's interesting because as a character actor, and I usually leave a movie and then I don't see it until it's in the theaters or show on television. But this one turned out to be one that I've been associated with ever since we shot it, because the post-production took a while, and there were things that we had to work on, and I was able to recommend people, you know, to Kevin to maybe fill in some gaps for him, and so he would keep showing me the cuts as we went along, you know, and the rough cuts, and the rough cuts got cleaner and cleaner and cleaner until we got a really nice edit and a really nice form. I think it was a crowd pleaser, you know, and I was really pleased to see that. But I think my character, I think Uncle Bishop really adds that groundedness to the whole thing, the seriousness of it. You know, you can be bouncing off the walls and you can be all this crazy stuff, but Bishop is sort of, no, this is what you got to do. You got to do this. You got to do that. Yeah. This is wrong. This is right, you know.
All art's about communication, but acting's somewhat unique because you're creating art by communicating someone else's artistic vision. And I'm wondering if there's a kind of responsibility with that, you know, and how you approach that. I mean, obviously, with this film, you say, you know, you've had a continuing relationship. But from an acting perspective, when you feel you're trying to help someone realize that their vision is that something you give thought to?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I mean, that's why the communication with the director is so important, because you sometimes can miss the nuances, at the beginning, and you really want to understand who he is to really make a clear connection. Acting is about choices, and acting is about listening, and listening to the other actor, but also listening to the director when he has a clear idea of who this guy is. Sometimes your interpretation of it changes his perception of it, and he says, no, I like what you're doing better. No, that's right. That's who Bishop is, because it rings true. I mean, that's what we, James Cagney said about acting. It's really simple. You just walk up to the guy, you look him in the eye, and you tell the truth. And it's the truth part that's the hard part. And so when you're trying to find a character and trying to interpret someone else's vision of a person, you're trying to find the truth. And sometimes the shades of truth that you bring to it take it off the page, and make it more satisfying for the writer and the director as what they had envisioned. I've done that before in certain ongoing characters and series where I was able to talk to the writer before we even went into production on the rest of the series about exactly what my character was, and that was very rewarding. In this case, they had a good idea for Bishop, and I understood who Bishop was. I could relate to him. But I think any actor has to bring his own truth to it, or it rings false. And it just does, it ring like, it doesn't ring like a bell. It doesn't have a bell to it. It's just like a thud.
And that's a really challenging part, as you say, because, I mean, it's hard enough to live your own personal life from a place of truth, but when you're having to do it on a big screen and convey someone else's truth, that's a whole other thing.
Yeah, it is, but it's about the one thing that's different about acting in front of a camera and in front of an audience is that the only reality that you're dealing with is the other actor in the scene with you. It's not, you're not performing for an audience. That's a trick. That's a translation that some actors have more difficulty with than others, and in both directions, and so that's why I think when you are really engaged with an actor, with the other actor, you're really listening to that other actor, you're really watching in intent on where they are, and you're giving it back. I think that builds the scene. I think in this movie, when James and I did our very first scene, which was in the old building that was under construction, I mean, when we met, and we, that's how the movies are, and it was extremely hot, but because of the way Peter and Michael put it together, they wanted us to do a really long master, a much longer master shot than you usually do, and so it was 6 pages long or something, and we just did it as one long shot, because with Peter's handheld techniques we were able to move through 3 rooms and keep the scene going without cutting for the master, and that allowed James and I to really build a momentum to really be able to listen, to find the nuances in who he was, let me discover who he was, and he could discover who I was, and our relationship is important because I'm really his only family that he has left, and I'm sort of, oddly enough, his base. So that technique really sort of helped in the listening and the developing the relationship, so I really knew who he was.
Well, thanks so much for sharing that. It's been lovely talking to you, and good luck with the film.
Oh, thank you so much. Yeah, it's a fun ride. I think the audiences really like it. They did last night.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Well, thank you again.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copland, and my guests this week from the film The Dunning Man. And I think Tom Kemp there is right. It is quite the ride, this film, so it's definitely worth seeing. Well, next, let's hear about how the wonderful soundtrack of the movie came into being. I'm with Dwayne Gittins now, is that right? Yeah, Dwayne Gittins, with my British accent there, who is a music contributor to the film The Dunning Man. And it does have an amazing soundtrack. I saw the world premiere last night. It's got some great songs. Now, I understand that some of these are your own music. So how did you become involved with this project?
So Brent Butler, who's a producer on the film as well, music supervisor, him and I, we are sort of a hip-hop duo, and a lot of the music that's in The Dunning Man came around the time that him and I put out our project called The Cold Press. So originally the songs were just placeholders, but eventually they wound up fitting, so everybody just kept the music in, and so... Yeah.
And how is it seeing your music with visuals? I mean, it gives it another element. Obviously, music videos are an art form in and of themselves. What was it like sort of seeing the music with the film?
It's kind of cool that my music is telling a completely different story, if that makes sense. Because what's on record, it's one thing, but to kind of combine it with something else, you know, that's completely separate of that and has nothing to do with it, it's like it's giving it a whole new life, so to speak.
Yeah. Kind of like a collage effect, almost. Yeah, you're sort of adding to something or creating something new out of two different parts.
Absolutely, absolutely. And it's just so cool how it still tells the same story, because if you think about all the other music contributors, Joey Fortuna, the Ryan Brothers, the Pogues, and then you have Brent and I and some of our other friends who are hip-hop artists, it kind of shows that compare and contrast between sort of like old and new, and it also sort of represents the relationship between Connor and Stryker. Stryker being a hip-hop artist, Connor coming from this rich Irish background that's so deeply rooted in heritage and loyalty and things like that, and even still... Those are the kind of same principles that he shares with Stryker as well, coming from the hood, being a rap artist, you know, being rooted in principles. So it's just so cool how there's so many twists and turns, and there's so many different dynamics that go into the music and how it pair well with the film itself.
Now, it sounds like for this film, the songs pre-existed. Is that correct? Yeah.
Some of them, yeah.
So some of them were written for the film?
Yeah.
Okay, because I was going to ask you about that process, how that differs, how you might approach that differently.
It's pretty much, I would say it's a little bit easier, just because, you know, when it comes to being an artist yourself, you're kind of creating from your own personal experience, and sometimes it gets a little bit hard trying to draw that emotion out of yourself and put it in a way that's kind of palatable for everybody else to digest. But when it comes, you know, from another place, and you're pretty much given a template, like, okay, here's the movie, this is what it's about, it's kind of a little bit easier because you're not necessarily coming from an autobiographical standpoint. You're just trying to convey what's already there on film just in a musical capacity. So it kind of works having something set up for you, and you're just pretty much following along, really.
Is the soundtrack of the movie going to be available, or some of the songs your song?
We've been talking about it. Kevin, you know, the executive producer, have said that he feels the soundtrack itself should just be something that stands alone. But in the meantime, you can find a lot of the music, once again, from me and Brent's project, The Cold Press, on all the major streaming platforms, Apple Music, Spotify, Google Play, Tidal, things like that. And we have...
What is the name of your duo?
Oh, we're just Brent Butler and Decent.
Okay.
Yeah, so that's spelled DEASCENT. So if you look that up on any streaming platform, you'll be able to find the music. And a lot of, I want to say maybe 4 to 5 songs are in the actual film. So you get a good chunk of what you saw in The Dunning Man that you enjoyed. And there's also some solo stuff from me and Brent respectively. So we just kind of mashed everything together to help usher along the film in a music way.
And finally, what drew you to music as your art form?
I grew up in a musical household, primarily hip-hop, because my uncle, he was a rapper, my dad, he was a DJ, and them just having like a real eclectic ear, so to speak. So just being around it, and then my love for writing kind of combined with that, and then eventually it led to performing, which led to recording, and all these things just kind of built up, and here I am today.
Well, thanks so much for talking to me, and I really hope that the film gets a wide distribution so that people can enjoy the film, but also your wonderful music. It was really great. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you, and thank you for having me.
You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copland. Thanks very much again to Duane Gittins there. My guests this week are from the film The Dunning Man, which had its world premiere at the Cinequest Film Festival. We're going to a break now, but I'll be back with more conversation after these messages.
Ciao, I'm Luca from Tramonti at 528 Seabright Avenue, steps from the ocean. We are the authentic Italian pizza and pasta restaurant, serving also organic salad and house-made dessert in a friendly family-style atmosphere, indoor or on our lovely patio.
Tramonti is open every day from noon to 9 and later on Fridays and Saturdays. Come enjoy our specials every Tuesday neighborhood night and the best deal for a healthy bite at lunch every day.
We bake our bread and prep our fresh pasta and pizza daily. Beppe, Daniel and I want to say grazie to the Santa Cruz community for supporting us in the past 2 years. Allora, buon appetito!
Visit Luca and Beppe at Tremonti, 528 Seabright Avenue. That's Tremonti, 528 Seabright Avenue.
Can you imagine living without stress, anxiety, or fear? And can you imagine a life filled with harmony and inner peace? Is that even possible? The Ananda Yoga and Meditation Center in Scotts Valley offers simple tools to help you become more effective at work and more centered in the face of life's challenges. At Ananda, we offer yoga classes for everybody, inspiring workshops, devotional chanting, and Sunday services based on the teachings of Paramahansa Yogananda. Our teachers and therapists are highly trained professionals who work together to inspire a healthier you. And your first Ananda Yoga class is always free. Visit us at anandascottsvalley.org or call 338-YOGA. That's anandascottsvalley.org or 338-YOGA.
Welcome back. You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copland. This week, my guests are from The Dunning Man, and the last filmmakers that I spoke to are Emmy Award-winning cinematographer Peter Sickhart and the film editor Ian Bloom. And they talked to me about how the story of a film is pieced together through the way shots are filmed and the choices that are made through editing. It's fascinating how many parts there are to making the visual art that is a film: the story, the directing, the acting, the music, the cinematography, the editing, and all the various parts have to be good for the film to work. So let's hear from Peter and Ian about the aspects of bringing the film together in terms of shooting it and editing it.
My name is Petr Sickhart, and I was the cinematographer on Dunning Man.
And Ian Bloom, the film editor.
So one of the other people I spoke to mentioned that there was a lot of editing, and I don't know whether maybe there was a lot of advanced storyboarding, because there were a lot of different locations. Was that something that had to be given a lot of thought in the film?
Well, Michael and I met about the movie about a year and a half before we ever started shooting the movie. Okay. And I think we kind of laid out the type of style that we would like to see, the references, movies, paintings, pictures, photos, the texture of the movie. We spent a lot of time talking about the character. To me, as a cinematographer, the most important thing, I think, is to tell a story and to portray the story visually, and to help the director, being able to show the character the way he wants, and sort of support him with my visuals. And I think if you watch the movie, James, who played Connor, is really kind of stuck in his world. It's unsure, it's discovering, it's trying to figure out what to do. It's quite unhappy, is anxious, is jittery. And so we figured, let's try to do that with the work of the camera and see if we can sort of follow his journey in that same style. And so we shot a lot of it not very traditionally. We never had marks for actors as a rule. It was always, we never really lit for particular spots. We lit spaces rather than lighting scenes. Mm-hmm. We chose lenses that would allow us to do really long takes and just run the scenes in its entirety. I think the crew, I kind of became known as the famous Peter 360 style of shooting. And it was, so the camera was handheld, it was 360, everything was fair. There were no obstacles on set that I couldn't go to. And as a result, the actors had absolute freedom.
Yeah.
So, I think the actors appreciated it because they could go more or less anywhere they wanted in the room. I would follow them and I would capture what they felt like. We would give them pointers, what we thought was important, which areas of the locations were good for them to be in at particular time of the scenes, where it might be better for lighting. But generally, they were very free. Yeah. So on one hand, they loved it because they felt like they never had to be sort of stiff and making sure they hit the right mark and all of that. On the other hand, it's a little bit hard because they were never off. It was never like, now we're shooting James, you can relax and just do your lines. It was like, no, I could go to you or James or anyone else in the scene at any moment. Okay. So they were all like, oh, I guess we never get a break. Yeah. And I think that visual style is very interesting.
Yes.
I think it did go well with the movie. I think it made Ian's life difficult, at least in the beginning, because it's not, you have to search.
You get a lot more footage, do you?
You get a lot. Well, I don't know if you get a lot more footage, but you certainly have to search for what's there because it's not like, well, now I have four versions of a close-up and that's what it's going to be because every take, it might be different.
Yes.
And he got to know my style pretty well editing and maybe he could talk about how he transmitted that style to the screen, to what you end up seeing.
That's not a common approach, is it, what you're describing?
I would say it's not. I think it's probably becoming a little more popular. I don't know if it's very uncommon, but it's not certainly not traditional.
No.
I come from before I started to do fiction. The last 5 years, I did quite a bit of documentary. So for me, it's very natural.
Right.
To do that, and my camera, handheld camera work. I'm capable of capturing things as they unfold.
Yeah.
So traditional, maybe not, but I would also say that maybe it's being used maybe more and more. I think for the actors, it's fantastic. Every actor I work with in this style, if I do this style, they love it. They really appreciate it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's really interesting. Yeah, I could see that.
It's
now,
like being on stage, I think, for an actor, from their perspective, it's like it's a natural breakdown of we're in this scene together. And
yes.
It's very natural conversationally.
Yeah.
You respond to each other in the moment. You're more like immersed in it than if the camera is here on a tripod and we're shooting four takes of you sitting there and the person in the other chair is not going to be covered for the next 2 hours. They have to remember what they did when they finally move the camera across the room and shoot the other side of it.
Right.
With Peter's style, the actors got to basically be in theater.
And what about
the boom operator? Didn't like it very much. he was all over the place. but I think the goal is for the actors to forget that there's a camera.
Yeah.
Right.
To be just like we like to like the spaces, and have the lighting tell the story of that space. We like the actors to feel like they're just in life rather than making a movie and being stiff about it.
So you wouldn't also be telling them what shots are coming up, like I'm doing a big close-up of you now? No.
When people ask me, are you doing the master shot now? I'm like, no, what do you mean? No, what is it? It's all masters, and I can be at anywhere at any time. And, they're all masters in different lenses, different sizes.
Yeah.
They don't know. They don't know what I do, and I think it's good. It works.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, the editor is... don't know if serving is the right word, collaborating, you know, with the director's vision, the DP's vision, and they're also often referred to as the actor's friend, because you can kind of make or break an actor's performance on how you edit them. How do you hold all of those different things, or are they all the same thing in your mind?
They're all part of the same process for me,
right.
Which is making the best film possible, and sometimes being brutally honest with any given performance or even the script.
Right.
Most importantly, where you are taking an idea that everybody was in love with when they read it and realizing that either it doesn't work or it works much better in a very different way.
Right.
And creating meaning and thought is really my primary thing. Like, I love, the reason that I am drawn to editing is the way it mimics thought. The way that you can manipulate what someone takes out of a scene, whether you're going to show me if this is a scene in a film and I'm talking about film editing, is it more interesting or is it more important for the overall story to see me do that, or is it more important to see you react to me doing that? Or am I such a bad actor that I can't get through the whole scene in one, like, really good, clear take, and we need to cut in and out of four or five different versions of that performance to create what is the best performance? And, you know, that's really doing that in a graceful, like, seamless way is really what it's all about.
I mean, I could add to that. Part of the reason to shoot this way, I mean, besides giving the freedom, but it also gives a freedom to me as a cinematographer, because if you're on a dolly or on a tripod or on a crane, you're a little bit stuck to your confinements. I mean, you know, if you're on a dolly, you can move. If you're on a crane, you can move around as well. But what it allows me to do is to photograph emotion. And, you know, I think that's something, it's emotion is not necessarily displayed on somebody talking. You know, the emotion is displayed by people's body language, their hands, their fidgeting, their feet, the way they breathe, the way they look around. And if I have the option to break off from the main actor talking and go to the one listening, because, you know, I think it may be far more emotional to see somebody crying because something that they're being told than somebody telling them whatever they're telling them.
Yes.
Or reacting. So, you know, I'm watching with my left eyes, I'm shooting what's going on around me. And if I realize there's another actor having a reaction to what's being said, I can go to them freely.
Yes.
And capture those hands or the feet. Yes. or the look into nowhere or whatever that is.
It's valuable if there is no, if, you know, a lot of editors will tell you that if there's a performance happening with dialogue, that needs to be on camera at all times, at least from the sense of how to shoot a scene. But there are some very honest reactions that you don't get when you're like, okay, now this is going to be your take and we want to shoot that reaction. And Peter is great at catching those. And sometimes you're also given the fact that, like, when you've gone across the room and you're shooting this moment that would not have been caught in a traditional way, the best version of the take that is actually, like, in the script is happening off camera. But that's kind of okay too, because it's happening for the same reasons, because the camera is not in their face.
I'm really interested in how memory is iconographic, you know, what we choose to remember, events and stories of our lives. And when you were talking about making those different choices, I was thinking, you know, that's what you're doing, isn't it? Is you're creating those moments and piecing them together in the way for the viewer then to see the story. I don't know, I just haven't really thought about it like that.
It's absolutely true. I mean, yeah. You look at this conversation. You know, there's three of us sitting here talking, you know, but there's all sorts of things that happen, and they happen visually, and they have nothing to do with our conversation. But probably a year from now, I probably won't remember how we were sitting or your face, but I'm pretty sure I'll remember the lady who just walked by with the garbage can, completely unaware of what we were doing. You know, yeah. I probably will remember these lampshades. I'll remember the posture of our friends who are standing there waiting for us, wanting to go grab a coffee or whatever they're doing. You know, all those little things is our mind captures in a scene. You know, mm-hmm. this was a scene. And I think they're just as valid to the experience as just, you know, seeing the three of us talking.
Yes, absolutely. Well, I thought the film was very interesting visually and very engaging. So well done, both of you. And thank you very much for talking to me.
Great. Yeah, you're welcome.
Thank you very much. I mean, yeah, it's the trick of knowing where to use that material, too. When to have the woman walk by with the garbage can, or when to show the impatient friends who are like waiting to get out of here, or you know, like that's really where the fun happens for me, I think.
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, if you watch the film, you know, there is a scene where James is by swimming pool, sort of on a phone call, and you know, is yelling into the phone with the lawyer, and you know, I just thought like not the most important angle, but one of the angles is the pool. And, you know, I asked all the people who were just, I think, hanging out by the pool, I said, would you be in the movie and just watch this guy going crazy over there? And so all those great reactions were because I just went after those people and I said, I want to film you. And then I thought, like, in the middle of the scene, I'm going to get into the pool with the camera on my shoulder, and I asked the guy to come and just swim by. Uh-huh. And it makes for a fantastic it's for a great shot. It makes for a great shot, and it's that type of thing that happens in life.
Yes. Yeah.
But when you talk about the construction of a scene, and you have a scene with one person on a phone call, you need that stuff. As an editor, I desperately need that stuff to be able to do what you were just talking about, which is craft that performance. Yeah. The other part of that is the other half of the phone call, which is a complete blank canvas, as far as I'm concerned, that you can have, you know, you can rewrite it. Yeah. Anything that works as a response is fair game. Yeah. So,
well, thank you so much, both of you.
All right, of course. Cheers.
You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copland, and thanks again very much to all my guests from the film The Dunning Man, which had its world premiere at the Cinequest Film Festival. I think it's really interesting hearing how all the different parts come together, as I said earlier, and it certainly was interesting visually. So learning about how Peter Sickhart filmed it with this very different style of not setting up shots in the way that are normally done with, you know, the tripod and with shooting in this direction or whatever. It's not something I'd really come across before, so I thought that was pretty interesting. So watch out for The Dunning Man. You can follow it on Facebook, and hopefully down the line, after it's been around the festivals, it will have a theatrical release. So again, that's The Dunning Man. And just to remind you, It's a Question of Balance has a topic hour and a guest hour. So be sure to tune in to hear thought-provoking topic discussions on the street, as well as inspiring interviews with guests from the arts. And of course, if you go to the website, itsaquestionofbalance.com, you can find podcasts there from all previous shows. If you go to the homepage at the top, there's a topics tab and a guest tab. Click on one of those and you will see all the photographs of all the different topics and guests. So click on them and you'll get the audio. Thanks very much for listening. I look forward to you joining me again next time.